Welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast. My name is Walter Latham, your host, and I'm joined by Michelle Sweeney McCombs. We have a very, very special guest today. Actually, it's a milestone for the Walt Weekly Podcast, and this is our 101st episode. So it complements that. It's a milestone for us, and we have a milestone level guest. You couldn't get any higher than this. And I do want to start by saying that this man needs no introduction. He's a legend in his own time. He created the Kings of Comedy, the Queens of Comedy, was the executive producer of Martin Lawrence's Run, Tell That, and made box office history with the highest grossing comedy shows of all time. He is a film producer and a philanthropist. Let's welcome Mr. Walter Latham.
Yes, welcome.
Hey, welcome. I don't know if anyone noticed it, but he has got the same last name.
Yeah, we do. That's coincidence. I don't know whether you want to drill into why that's the case, but
it's up to you. The strange guy that has the same name as me.
That's right.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
What an honor, right?
It is. It's an honor and a privilege and a blessing, all in one. I couldn't.
Yes.
You know, I'm beyond words. Okay. Also, my birthday was yesterday, so this is cool.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, awesome. Thanks for the greetings. I mean, yeah, the well wishes from you and your beautiful wife. Junior, so thank you. And the reason that we have the same name, and I think I'll save it for the end, but you know, you are Walter Latham Jr. and I am Walter Latham Senior.
That's right.
I am your, you know, I'm dad. You're my son, and I love you very, very much.
Amazing.
Okay.
What a birthday gift, right?
Awesome. Yes, doesn't get any better than this. I mean, really, you know, and I get emotional, you know. So y'all gotta excuse me.
Passionate.
Let me take a second.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very passionate.
Yeah. So anyway, we want to welcome Walter Latham to the Walt Weekly Podcast. All right.
Yes.
And we want to start by asking some questions. But before we proceed with that, he is the CEO of Latham Entertainment, as I indicated before. Would help launch the careers of noted comedians and comic actors, including Bernie Mac, Steve Harvey, Monique, Cedric the Entertainer. And his releases, the original Kings of Comedy, the Queens of Comedy, Latham Entertainment Presents, and the Bad Boys of Comedy have grossed more than $200 million worldwide. So I did want to include that because this man he's a legend. And we're so honored to have him.
Thank you so much for saying that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I feel welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. So we're going to start with some questions. First of all, how are you doing today, Junior? I got to stop saying Junior.
The day has been going good. And I was looking forward to this. Like I said, I had a little technical difficulties, but here we are. So it's all good.
It's all good.
All right. Okay. You know, I just want to thank you and for taking the time out of your busy day, because I know you're a busy man.
Yes, sir.
And to spend some time with TWW.
Yes, sir.
All right. And first off, could you tell us how it feels to look back at all you have accomplished and all you will accomplish? I know, but just to look back at your career up to now, how does it feel?
Surreal. Sometimes it doesn't feel like the life that I thought I deserved, believe it or not. We can talk about that later, but I never grew up thinking like I was going to do this, you know, and be successful at this. The one thing that I can say is I've always been a go-getter. Like, I had my first job when I was 12. I had my first real job when I was 15. So I always had an entrepreneurial spirit. But as far as entertainment, I never realized that I would be able to use that entrepreneurial skill to actually build a business and work with the people that I've worked with, and gross the kind of money that we've grossed. And like you said, we continue. You know, we just made three deals last year, one with Paramount, one with CBS. So we have some shows coming up in the next 18 months.
Nice.
And it's just like you said, it's a blessing because some of that stuff just found me. You know, I didn't even go looking for it.
Right, you know, right. So, like being in the right place at the right time.
The right time, exactly. Right. And you have to be prepared. What I tell a lot of young kids, when opportunity presents itself, you have to be prepared to take advantage of the opportunity. So a lot of people say, well, I got you, you were at the right place at the right time. And it's because of this, because of that. And honestly, I don't buy it. I think anybody who had some kind of drive and determination could have also accomplished what I did. They just happened to not go after what I went after. You know, I know a lot of people who are famous and rich and wealthy and all that who took a different path, but it still ended up being their path. So getting back to my blessing, you know, God obviously pointed me in this particular direction to do what I've done so far and to also enable me to be able to sit back and wait on what it is I want to do next. You know, a lot of people have to do stuff like every got to always be doing something. Right. And we're blessed to say, okay, you know what? I don't want to do those 10 things. Let's keep looking for more things. And I never knew that I was going to turn 50. And like you said, be able to look back over the last 30 years. When I told my nephews one day, I said, you know, it's funny. You guys talking about jobs. I haven't worked a job since I was 20 years old. Period. You know?
Right.
I haven't had a boss. So, like, I don't know what that's like, but I like the way it is now.
Right.
So,
you
know, people say, well, when are you going to retire? I'm like, why? I can do what I do from my wheelchair. Like,
exactly.
I don't, you know, you just putting deals together and you're putting people together and you're producing it. And, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, I plan to do this for another at least 20 years.
And I
love it, you know.
So, yeah, that's the most important thing, doing something that you love to do.
Yeah,
I think I'm at that place now. But, you know, I do want to ask you, you know, how did you start? You know, what made you decide to pursue a career in entertainment?
Right. I think it was divine intervention, honestly, because I was working a regular job, you know, making regular money. And I think I went to see someone I had grew up with in elementary school. Her name was MC Light. She, you know, we grew up together from probably the third grade on. And anyway, I went to see her perform when I was like 18 or 19. And I realized like I wanted to be in that because I'm like, she's in it. How can I get in it? But I wasn't talented. Right. You know, I couldn't rap. I couldn't sing. I couldn't dance. So I'm like, well, I asked her, I was like, well, how would I get in? How would somebody like me get in the business? And she told me about what promoters do. And I was like, wow, that seems like something I can do, you know, but it was a couple of years down the road before I actually got to do it, but it was already implanted. When I had that conversation with her, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
And it moved rather quickly. We had that talk when I was 18. I had my own company when I was 20. So, you know, it moved very, very fast.
Quick. Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of times you think of things, you know, ideas but it's the execution.
Exactly.
You know, if you never execute it, then it didn't mean anything. The idea didn't mean anything.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
So you're from Brooklyn, Walter?
I'm from Brooklyn.
Me too. actually lived around the corner from my aunt, MC.
Oh, yeah. She went, because we went to different middle schools. I went to Marine Park Junior High School. I think she ended up, like you said, she went in Brooklyn somewhere.
Yes,
I can't remember where.
But
yeah, we lost touch. And then, when we did get back together, it was crazy. She was bringing me a script that she wanted me to produce. And I had to put the script down and look at it. And I'm like, can you believe we're here? You're doing what you're doing. I'm doing what I'm doing. And then maybe we could do something together. Like, did we ever know when we were like 9 or 10 that we was going to, you know, we were going to meet and our path was going to cross. So we still stay in touch. I guess she's on the set of Queen of the South, I think. So we talked before.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
She is?
Yeah, she's a character.
She's a character.
I mean, that's one of my favorite shows. Which character does she play?
She's, you know, the Devin Finch, and he had his right-hand girl. Devin Finch is a CIA guy.
Yeah.
Well, she was
West Indian guy. Well, that's where
Yeah. She was his right-hand man. So yeah, we've, you know, even now, like, you know, to get somebody to call you or text you while they're on set, you have to be pretty close to them. That's so amazing. You know, yeah. So yeah, we're still close, and I'm excited that, you know, to have her as a lifelong friend.
Okay. What I do want to revisit, you know, prior to starting Latham Entertainment, which you are the CEO of, you mm-hmm. know, what were you doing, though, you know, in that 2-year period? What were you yeah. doing, basically?
When you say, what 2-year period?
Well, the 2-year between the time you came up with the idea and the time that you actually executed on the idea.
From 18 to 20, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. You were working.
The idea was starting my own company and doing my own events. Okay. You know, it took a while okay. for me to even, you know, I had to raise money. I had to get the right. acts. I didn't know who represented the acts. I had to do contracts I had never seen before. Mm-hmm. It was just the entry. It was almost like birthing me into the business of entertainment. And it was bad. It was hard. I won't say bad. I would put my own flyers on cars in the snow. I would go to radio right. stations at night to get them to promote the shows mm-hmm. for me and give them some money for that. And like, I just love the whole process of, like you said, having an idea and then executing the idea.
Right.
You know, a lot of people come to me over the years and say, you know what? I promoted Kings of Comedy. I created that some years ago, and I just never could pull it off. It was going to be Red Fox, and it was going. Why are you telling me that though? What difference does it make?
Right.
It's almost like I stole his idea that he had, right, but right. he never executed. And I'm like, right. first of all, I don't
you made
know
it happen,
you. And it happened. Just, I executed the idea I had. I wasn't taking it from anybody, or you know. Right. So, you know, those kind of things. But that's entertainment. I've been sued. I've been accused. Mm-hmm. It's just the more successful you are, the right. harder it gets to stay successful. I used to tell my kids, getting to the mountaintop is difficult, but right. staying there is virtually almost impossible. Like, you have right. to be such a special person to endure staying at the top at that right. level. You know, so like, you know, my journey, my 30-year journey hasn't been, you know, roses, but I right. think for the most part, you know, I have a good reputation. I've worked with a lot of really cool people and interesting people. And like you said, I continue to have that ability and to have, you know, I just think, you know, to be doing it at the level that I continue to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, at 50, I keep saying that because it's like such a big deal to me. I'm like, where am I going to be when I'm 50? Where am I going to be?
Right. Now you're there.
Now I'm here. So it's like, you know, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? But it has to, you know, it has to be entertainment because it's, you know, it's, right. it's what I do. It's what I know. You know, I know this better than any other thing I was taught in my life. So.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, you're in your comfort zone. You're doing what you love. I mean, you can't ask for more than that. You really can't.
Right. And I love the fact that, you know, you mentioned that you were handing out your own flyers, you were doing all of the legwork. Most all entrepreneurs have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, you know, start from the bottom. You know, who yep. has money to pay people to do your marketing for you? So mm-hmm. that's awesome.
Yeah. I just asked, you know, used to tell my employees, you know, this is one thing you got to know for certain. I will never ask you to do something I haven't already done.
Right.
So if I'm telling you to put a flyer out, I've put flyers out before in my past, you know, so everything I'm getting showing you is preparing you to operate at the level in this business that I operate at. But you have to start somewhere and you have to
right.
humble yourself and say, okay, I'm going to start. I used to tell them, well, you already have so much for us to do. Sometimes I was like, look, put you a list together, A through Z, and then just start at the top and work your way down.
Right.
As long as I see that you're making an effort to go through the process and get things done, I'm fine. I just don't like when people say I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should I right. unstick you? Because if I'm going to unstick you, I might as well do it by myself.
Right. Right. That's true.
So, yeah. You know, it's stuff like little lessons like that, you know, you kind of learn over the years. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of a situation where, I've always worked for somebody, you know, that even if it was in a contractual sense. Until I retired. But anyway, it reminded me of an incident that occurred, and I was managing in a department, and I went into the big boss, you know, went into his office and said, oh, blah, 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 we got this problem. And he looked at me and he said, well, I mean, you're the manager of the area. So, I mean, what are you telling me? Do you have a solution? I said, no, I'm just letting you know. He said, well, I don't want to know. Why am I paying you?
Right.
Yep. And right then I turned around and that was a lesson learned right then. And that's the way I've carried myself forward. You know, and that's what you're saying.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
That's right. Yep. What am I paying you for? Yeah.
I might have to wear, get a shirt about that. What am I paying you?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm telling you. But, Junior, I mean, Walter.
Yes.
Did you ever think, I know we this may be a little bit redundant, but I mean, you're a mogul. I'm trying to just try to feel, I mean, how does that feel when you wake up in the morning knowing that you're a mogul, even though you, and nobody gave that to you. You, like you said, you worked your ass, excuse my expression, but your A-all to get to this point. But to get up there, as you said, the main, you're on the top of the mountain and you got to try to maintain, and people are, you know, it's lonely at the top, as you said, but you're a mogul. How's it feel, man?
Only when people say it to me like you did.
You think about it, right?
I would think about it like that. I mean, I've had articles and, you know, stuff like that that referenced me as such. But I don't know, man. I think it's probably where I came from. I came from, like, such a humble beginning. It's almost like I'm just – it sounds crazy. It almost feels like I'm surviving. You know, I'm from the streets of Brooklyn, man. I got people I went to middle school with are dead. People I went to high school with dead or homeless or whatever. You know, to get out of there is way bigger to me than being a mogul, you know, because I would have never been a mogul had I had Brooklyn, the Brooklyn streets kind of get me.
Right.
So, you know, much credit to everybody who was in my life. But, it's you got to survive. I walked with my head down when I was in Brooklyn because I, you know, I didn't want any trouble. And
Tough streets.
It's very, very tough streets. And I've seen a lot of things in my life. But anyway, back to the mogul, you know, I think it's a great compliment and I appreciate you saying it. And I always try to live up to that. But I just feel more humble now than I was probably when I was 30, you know, because I can look at 30, I can look back at the last 10 years of my career. Well, now I can look back at the past 30 years. Right. And to be called that, I'll take it. You know, I'm not against it, but I don't wake up every morning and think, oh, it's me, Walter Latham. Look what I am. Look what I've done. I'm just a regular dude that live in the country. You know that, Pop.
I know.
I don't need a lot.
Right.
I don't need a lot. So, you know.
Yeah, man, I'm trying to get
big head.
You know, I do this for the benefit of the listeners too, you know.
Yes.
So, to try to get them the, you know, some information as to, you know, a little bit more in depth, even though these are something that if we were talk, it would be just, okay, right. But I do want them to try to get that viewpoint from where you are. Okay.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, back when you started, you know, there was a lot of entertainment entrepreneurs that gravitated towards hip hop. Russell Simmons, Diddy. Why did you go to comedy instead of to hip hop?
As far as getting into comedy, at that time that I got into it, there was only one other person doing it. He was a white guy from St. Louis, Missouri. And my path actually ended up crossing with his.
Okay.
And he, when Chris Tucker got really big after the movie Friday, he wanted me to do all of his shows because we were close. But his agent, his white agent, did not want me to do it because he had never heard of me. He didn't know if I had the money, whatever.
Right.
So he put me together with a guy who actually ended up being my mentor. So just that quickly, from nobody taking your calls to everybody, well, who are you? What do you do? Immediately when I went in business with him, everybody started taking my call. So, amazing. You know, you have to align yourself, you know, with the right. It's so many levels of trying to be successful and stay, you know, it's just a lot. This business is very seductive.
Right.
And if you're not careful, it'll get you, you know, and I tell people all the time, I said, the first time people talk to you on the phone in Hollywood, it's, oh my God, you're great. I love you. Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then the next call, they won't take it.
That's the business.
That's the business. If you're not doing or saying what they want to hear or say, they don't talk to you anymore. Like old Hollywood, kind of when I was coming up and it's kind of faded out now with all these young kids.
Right.
We answered every email and answered every call. Even if we knew the call was going to be something we don't want, it was a respect factor in Hollywood that you call people back and you email people back. So, you know, along the way, I've learned a lot of things from a lot of people. All the lessons weren't easy, but, you know, I've always respected people who came into my life to help me or to guide me or to partner with me. You know, my partner, he didn't, Robin Tate was the guy I was telling you about from St. Louis.
Okay.
He didn't know me hardly at all. And he put, we had one conversation, and from that conversation, he began to be my mentor, and I started doing my shows with him. You know, so every step of the way, I can kind of look from, like you said, what got you in the business? What made you stay in the business? Why'd you pick comedy? All of those things kind of tie up together. Comedy was something I thought I could make a mark on, but put me in business with they used to call Robin the king of comedy. And I remember I used to tell him, I'm like, you're not a king of comedy. I'm the king of comedy. and we would laugh about it. And then these articles starting to come out, you know, Wall Street Marketplace and USA Today and all these things. And they were referencing me as the king of comedy. I remember calling him and saying, so who's the king of comedy again? Did you read the Wall Street Journal today? So it was like, but it took him and his tutelage of me to really help me get to, you know, that next level. So Kings of Comedy was so big, but it took all of those steps
to get me to the point.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was prepared for it. When we came up with the idea, I was prepared to do the idea. And that, like I said, is kind of how I kind of ran my whole business.
All right. So that's a segue to what I'm going to ask you, Nate, is, you know, how difficult it was for a black man being in your position of running the show, you know, having control over production and creativity. You know, this is usually reserved for the white guys, but you had Robert Tate, right? So that probably, you know, what's the term I'm looking for? That was somewhat of an offset against what you would have faced as a standalone person in that position, right?
At that time, right, exactly. At 20, you know, 21, 22 years old, that was the way it was. And that's the kind of, you know, Hollywood is opening up and trying to be more colorful, for lack of a better word. But I remember, you know, there was a lawsuit against all the agents in Hollywood because they would get all the big shows to white promoters and all the small shows to black promoters. And again, here steps in another guy, David Steinberg, who managed Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and all these people. And we got close. And, you know, he, right in the middle of this lawsuit, he took me to the biggest agent's office and basically said, you know, Robin Williams is getting ready to go out for, you know, his last tour. He wants to put some dates together. And they presented me, and we want to give you four of them.
Wow.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Like, they did it to cover themselves.
Right.
But I was in the position to use that to better myself. So
That's right.
I wasn't suing you. I just want to make money and I want to do shows and all that good stuff.
Right. You flipped it. Make it work for you. Yeah.
Exactly. So they never won the lawsuit. Nothing ever came of it, obviously. But what came of it for me is I was tight with Robin Williams. Now I was tight with his manager. You know, so that opens up yet other doors. So everything kind of goes, if you look at it over the last 30 years, everything kind of goes with the other thing.
Yeah. That's another thing. Being in the right place at the right time, being able to take advantage of the opportunity. You know, when the train passes, you jump on. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that is critical. That is critical. Yep. You know, I always try to, you know, get out to my listeners and to, you know, anybody that's close to me, that you got to be ready. You know, you got to be ready. Yeah. You never know when that opportunity is going to arise, come up. You got to be ready for it.
Especially as an entrepreneur. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Right. You never know what's around that corner. You can get depressed and I had a bad
gotta
day.
Gotta be ready.
And I didn't get this deal, but you know, but I mean, I guess in your situation that's just par for the course, right?
Yeah, par for the course. Right. You come up with three ideas, you know, and you hope to get at least one of them made in the next 3 years. That's how it takes. I mean, a lot of times people think, oh, God, I can't believe this movie was so great. And you look at the movie and realize that movie started being developed 7-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the movies you see now in theaters weren't even, they've been developed for 7, 8, 9 years before you actually see them. And a lot of people don't realize that. And that's one of the things that bothered me about being the typical Hollywood producer. I didn't like, you know, mm-hmm. 2-3 years on one project. Like, it didn't make sense to me. I'm like, what are we doing? And mm-hmm. I've always gravitated back to the live stuff, you know, so Queens of Comedy and Latham Entertainment Presents and me and Diddy did Bad Boys of Comedy, those type of things. I can think about them right now in June and be filming in December. That's the urgency and immediacy like I need for my career. I don't like, I make deals and I have partners in place to do that, but I like to be a creator and just think of something and be doing that something within 6 months. So that's just me and my way of doing business.
Yeah, I always wondered about that too. Great.
Yeah.
I mean, it don't happen. I mean, when Diddy and I did Bad Boys of Comedy, we filmed July 04. He called me January 04. So in 6 months, maybe seven, we were shooting. He called with the idea. We had a couple of meetings in New York about the idea. I put the budget together. We found the people to produce it with us. Mm-hmm. And bam, we were filming, you know? And that's, to me, that gives me the drive. Like, I like the immediacy of,
yes,
you know what I'm saying? Like, it sounds probably, I don't know how it sounds, but bottom line is it gives me juice. Like, I feel really amped about that, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not on that level, because what you do 5 or 8, 10 years ago, you know, times have changed, you know, things evolve. So when you do something at that moment, it's more exciting because it's happening now.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know when we do our live shows, because, you know, we do a live show every Friday evening at 6 p.m. I mean, it's juice, man. I mean, we can. I know I feel the adrenaline.
Right.
I feel the adrenaline. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, when you're doing a one-on-one. Yeah, that's I feel the adrenaline also. But when you live, it's just, you live.
Totally different. Yeah.
It's a totally different animal.
Yeah, you got to be on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I want to move on a little bit now and talk about, you know, it's evident that you got an eye for talent. Walter, mm-hmm. you have an eye for talent, Walter. Mm-hmm. After all, you brought in like people like Bernie Mac, Cedric the Entertainer, Steve Harvey, and then later on D.L. Hughley. I can go on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how is it dealing with such personalities? I know these guys must have some ego, and you put them together like that. I mean, how did you manage that?
Right.
Barely.
especially when you were younger than them too.
I was so much younger than them, and they did not like getting ordered. They didn't want to hear from me. It was like, I remember one night, I guess I'll say it because it's not a bad thing. We had a clock on the stage that told each comedian when they had to stop. So as soon as they started, it started counting down. When it hit zero, they're supposed to come off stage because we have to stay on schedule. Because if not, the building and the union, they would all charge me like way more money. Anyway, Steve came off the stage one night, and I told him that. I was like, you know, we have to stick to the time, and this is why. And he looked at me. I'll never forget it. He looked at me like, who are you telling me what to do? I don't think, like, I was 25 maybe, and they all were in their, you know, early 40s, mid 40s.
Right.
So they're looking at me like, who are you? And I think that's just a mentality in Hollywood, period. Some black people just don't want to take instructions from other black people.
Right.
I think it's better now because we have so many people putting out hits that now I think people are open to more, you know, but back then, they didn't even want to give me, the guys on the tour didn't want to give me credit for putting the tour together. They were like, this wouldn't ever be if we didn't agree to do it. And we're telling the jokes, so you're not telling the jokes. And I'm like, okay. So dealing with egos, I have been doing my entire career. And the bad part I will say is at some point I developed that. I developed the ego, and I developed. So then you got me hot-headed trying to talk to an artist who's hot-headed, and we not getting nowhere, you know? So I learned that kind of, you know, in the last probably 20, maybe 15, 20 years to really just chill, you know, just, you know, if Bernie doesn't want me riding to the venue with Steve Harvey, fine, I'll just get my own car, you know? Things like that happen, you know? Why are you eating their catering all the time? You never eat with us. I'm like, wait a minute, are we children? what is, like, you didn't sit in the lunchroom and you didn't sit by me. I couldn't comprehend it. But when I thought about it, comedians are the most insecure people that you ever want to meet. Mm. You say, how can they be insecure? And they get in front of people and they tell jokes. That's their outlet. That's how they get their stuff out. You sit behind stage with them, like with Martin, when I did Martin, he was on fire on stage. And then afterwards, he would just sit there and talk and regular. And he was boring for the most part. And I was like, how does he do it? But sometimes, you know, they learn how to turn it on. Bernie Mac, he never turned off. So like Bernie in the airplane, at dinner, on stage, he was always the same. He was on fire like all the time. He was just funny. And people like Martin, you know, he was shy. But they both made it. You know, they both were successful in that field. So, you know, you can be different and carve out your own niche, but, you know, the business will get you. I mean, look at Dave Chappelle's story. Dave Chappelle did nothing wrong but step away from the game for a little while. That's all he did.
Right.
And then all those rumors and all that. And once he was ready mentally and physically, he put himself back out there and he's killing it. Mm-hmm. You know, but he had to go through whatever that was to get him to the place where he could actually start doing this again. So, you know, egos and insecure. I heard Eric Clapton say something once, and I have adopted it as my own. He said, I am a egomaniac with an insecurity complex. And that is me.
That's a good one. Yep. That's a good one to follow, too. I see some benefits in being that way. So. Absolutely.
That's funny because, you know, at your, I'm sorry to interrupt, Walter, but
go ahead, please.
It's similar to Justin when he was going on tour. My son, drummer, went international drumming with a band that was already established for a long time. They had the biggest egos. It was very hard for him to fit in because, one, they didn't respect him because of his age. And, you know, they underestimated his talent as well. But he would perform, go off stage, go in his corner, you know, do his thing. And then they would get upset with him because he wasn't drinking, he wasn't smoking, he wasn't doing, you know, the bad boys of jazz, what they were doing. So he kind of got labeled. And at first it was good. And then, you know, they started conflicting after a while because he's like, you know, I'm not going to just drink and smoke because you want me to.
Right.
You know, and I may be young, but I'm smart. You know, I'm mature. More mature than you think I am. So, yeah, he had difficulty on tour.
Yeah, once you take a stand on who you are and what, people will come around eventually.
Right.
You know, so you just got to stand firm in who you actually are.
Exactly. Especially when you're young.
What motivated you to bring the Kings of Comedy to theaters? I mean, because you had one of the biggest comedy tours in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. You were the number one comedy. Mm-hmm. Tour company. So what made you think, okay, I should take this to theaters?
You know, honestly, it was the first night that we did the show. We were going to just do three shows. And the first night I walked out of the tunnel, I think Bernie was on stage then, I walked out of the tunnel and I looked at the people. And they weren't just sitting down clapping. They were like standing up and dancing and running up and down the aisle like church. And I mean, this was everywhere. This wasn't just on the floor. This was up in the seats. And I said, this should be a movie. Like, literally, I said that to myself. Because I've seen all the prior movies. I've seen all the Eddie's movies. I've seen a lot of the Red Fox. And I mean, I know all of them. But I was like, this should be a movie. And from that day to the day we filmed it, I had to start going out to Hollywood, meeting with people, trying to make a deal. I remember one studio told me, they were like, okay, so tell me again, who's Steve Harvey and Bernie Mac? Who are they? And I was like, wait a minute, what is going on? So 2 years I just spent trying to make it happen. Again, how long stuff takes. I actually invited, this is my last chance. I gave myself, this is it. I invited every studio head in Hollywood, every production head. I got a limo to pick each one of them up from all over town, take them to a restaurant that I rented out just for them, and then bringing them to the show because I'm like, I want them to see the show so they can see what kind of movie I want to make. And they were all like in the third or fourth row. So the guy who always shot, you know, shot my shows, he would do, you know, audience pans and all that.
Right.
And I remember he panned the third row and nobody was laughing.
Oh,
nobody was laughing. Nobody was clapping. Boy. I was like, oh man, this is not going to work. This is, dang it. And I was sitting there telling myself, what's the next thing? Like, how do I get, anyway, that was on a Friday or Saturday. On that Monday, I got a call from MTV Films, and they wanted to talk more about my concept of the movie. And that was in May of 99. Mm-hmm. In October 99, they needed the head of MTV Films to see it. And he could only see it at Madison Square Garden in the fall, so in October. So May to October, I'm praying to God that this guy sees it and likes it as much as his colleagues.
Right.
And yeah, but when the show was over and he came backstage, you know, he was like, man, this is awesome. I love it. So what do you think in production budget-wise? What do you think it's going to take? And I was like, wait a minute, we getting ready to make a movie.
Okay.
And that was October 99, and we were filming in February 2000.
Wow.
It took 2 years to sell
and
3 months to film. And it was out in August of 2000, and it opened as the number two movie in the country.
Yes.
I never imagined that. Like, I was watching Entertainment Tonight, and I was like, they were talking about my movie. I was like, oh my God, this is crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, I can't imagine. I see how I imagine, but that's me.
Yeah,
that is something.
But yeah, that's where that comes from. So you got to be a little bit pushy, not rude, but you can't let that. It's so much happening so fast. Like, you can't let dirt grow. I mean, what they call it, grass grow on your feet, because you'll be late to the party. So you always got to be ahead of the game, What's next? What's next? Right. Who's next? So anyway, it's a little easier now because I kind of know what works for me. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what I would say to other people. You know, don't compare yourself or your career to other people. What works for them may not work for you.
That's
know, as long as you get the job done, do your thing. Anything you get up in the morning to do that you're excited about doing is probably what you should be doing.
Right.
And that may not be being a promoter or a producer or a director. And I'm going through that with my youngest son. He's going through his options now. He's trying to figure out, you know, what road to take. And I was like that at 23. I had my own company. He's 23 now, and he's trying to figure it out. So I guess the bottom line is, you know, follow your instinct, you know, trust your instinct. I obviously keep a level of faith in all of it because all of it ties back into that at some point. And learn how to take a back seat is what I would tell young people. Get the job done, but don't worry about getting the accolades because that'll come.
It'll come. Right. Yes.
And I'm telling you this, when you turn 50, those checks look better than accolades. Accolades, I can hang on a wall, but I can't take them to the bank.
Nope, that's for sure.
So it's nice to have
and
articles.
You're right about that. It comes later in life. Yeah,
it comes later if you're lucky, and you know we've been very fortunate. Very fortunate.
Yeah, you put the work in. That's the most
you gotta
important.
Put it you
gotta
in.
Put that work in. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I wanted to ask you too. How was it working with Spike Lee? I think he directed those.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was. Pretty easy, actually. You know, to the point. You know, how you want it? How do you envision it? That was the first talk that we had. Our first meeting we had was Spike. How do you see bringing this to the big screen? You know, and his ideas were solid. And he was Spike Lee. I mean, he's from Brooklyn. I was from Brooklyn. And like, it just made sense. You know, but what he said as a director to me as a producer, I bought it. I was like, okay, this is the person we should go with. And we met a couple of extra, you know, other directors, but he was the one. You know, I felt a connection to him. Like I said, we grew up in the same place. You know, I admire his work. I'm another black, you know, I'm a black producer. He's a black director. It just all made sense. So I had one conversation with him and he agreed to do it. So that's pretty much how it happened.
Okay.
Awesome.
All right. The Kings of Comedy has grossed millions of dollars, which we all know now, and has smashed box office records. Did you have any idea it would be such a history making event going
in? I knew it was going to be a money making event. Mm-hmm. I knew we weren't going to open at number 10 the way they kept telling us.
Right.
You know, we'll be lucky if we open at number 10. I'm like, I'm not opening at number 10. When you get into the executive level where you got people making decisions like that, you have to deal with those situations different than you would with everybody else. But
the comedy has grossed a million. The Kings of Comedy mm-hmm. has grossed millions of dollars mm-hmm. and has smashed box office records.
Right.
Right. Did you have any idea it would be such a history making event?
No, I didn't know it was going to be a history making event, but I knew it would be a lucrative event. I knew it would be a successful event. What ended up happening as far as opening up at number 2 as opposed to number 10 is it made people realize, oh, wait a minute, what is this? You know, who are these guys? Who is that guy?
Right. You know, taking a second look. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, for me, that's where the real prize came. When I released Kings, 3 months after that, I had a 5-year deal with Paramount. And then after that deal was over, I had a 7-year deal with Paramount. So those are the, what a word am I looking for? The residuals, I guess, mm-hmm. of that effort. But I never felt the effort going into it. It was going to be historic. Going into it, I felt like they weren't looking at it to be as successful as I was looking at it to be. Right. They just thought it was going to be a film. They throw it out there. Whatever happens, happens. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that. As far as history, no. But as far as being successful, I never doubted we would be successful. Ever.
Did it become easier for you?
It becomes easier in certain areas mm-hmm. and harder the further you go up, it gets harder because you're dealing with more important people and you're dealing with, you know, the stresses and their whole, you know, I'm really good friends with Charles King. I don't know if you guys look him up.
No, who is that?
Charles King is the CEO of a company called Macro, M-A-C-R-O. And Charles started off as my agent. And now he's like huge. They got nominated for an Academy Award. He produced a movie with the Black Panther theme movie.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Just came out. Yeah, the guy. I think the guy who starred in it won an Academy Award. But anyway, long story short, like, I just can't probably get him like I used to. Not because I'm not important, but because his life has taken on a different path. You know, so you got to kind of, you know, with an ego, you're like, I can't believe he ain't called me back yet. What the? It's crazy. But then you got to realize, wait a minute, he's in a whole new role. He has a whole new set of responsibilities. And he's doing great, you know, so. Wow. You got to take in a stride with this business, man. You can't let anything, you know, make you feel like you're bigger than what's really going on. You got to really be humble. You know, I was never humble in my 30s. Never. And I learned over time how to just be, you know, grateful.
Right.
And humble. And I'm not saying I don't have my bad days or I don't go ballistic if something, an email doesn't go out or if it goes out and it says the wrong thing. But for the most part, I'm, you know, I'm approachable now, I think, more so than I used to be. Mm-hmm. And after time, you realize, like you said, as far as success, you quantify it. What is real success? $100 million? $500 million? $1 million? You know, it don't matter to me at this point in my life as far as the amount of happiness and peace and love, all those things really matter to me. And people say, well, of course they don't matter to you because you're not worried about money. We don't have nothing to do with money.
It has nothing to do with money, yes.
You know, money's going to fade away. It's going to go away. But who you are, you can't take it with you. But your reputation you can leave behind is a good one.
Right.
Your philanthropy you can leave behind. You know what I'm saying? There's things that you can leave behind to continue the legacy of being just a good person. So,
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I tell the kids all the time is, you know, your credibility you can take to the grave with you. Right. You know what I mean? Exactly. As long as you got that credibility and the money, yeah, it's okay. You got to live. You got to eat. You got to pay bills. That's a situation we find ourselves in, right? So, yeah, but as you said, it's your legacy, what you leave behind that you know, people can admire and respect. You know,
and remember, yes.
All right, I got this question now. I don't know whether you want to go there, whether you answered it already from a different angle, but, you know, you were a multimillionaire in your 20s, right? And what challenges did you face? And what advice would you give to these young people today that find themselves all of a sudden, oh, I got $10 million, $20 million. I got this overnight. What advice would you give people like that? Because you've been there.
Yeah, I would say, especially early on, just remember the last time you were there to pay your light bill on time.
You never had a dime. Like you said, couldn't pay the light bill.
Right.
You know, and this and that. And now all of a sudden they got $20, $30 million. I mean, they're rich. Just like that.
It, you know what? It's hard to advise people who have $30 million. But I will say, at least from my own point of view, is it really changed my life? And sometimes at a level that I didn't want it to affect my life. It really, it caused harm to my life until I learned how to manage the success and the money and the my family, you know, which I lost. Actually, eventually I ended up losing my family because I just couldn't do it all well. So I would just ask young people to have like a solid foundation, obviously in church and with your family, you know, with your, you know, maybe mentors. I've had some really good mentors over the years, but I, you know, money will change things. I mean, it's just nowhere really around it, you know? So if you're not surrounded by people, I always tell people I surround myself by people smarter than me because I don't want nobody to tell me what I'm already saying. So that, you know, you learn that. You learn not to surround yourself with yes people because you'll go through your money real, real fast.
Right. I was going to say that. Do not surround yourself around yes people.
Yeah, they'll take you down.
Well, that's why Michelle's a partner, just for your info.
She knows.
Tell my son that quick, all the time. Yeah. Do not surround yourself.
Do you think that the Kings, when I refer to the Kings, I'm talking about Steve Harvey, mm-hmm. Cedric. Unfortunately, we lost Bernie, you know. Right. D.L. Hughley. Do you think they'd be where they are today without going through, you know?
No.
No, I don't think so either.
Breaking news. No. Breaking news.
Yes.
That's what I'm looking for. I'm always looking for breaking news. Yeah.
That made their careers. Yeah.
They act like it never happened.
Wow.
Ain't that something? How people.
Really?
I don't know. What
I had one instance. Let's see, it's 2021, 2020 was the pandemic. So at the end of October 2019, I had a meeting at Steve's house for the first time in 20 years. And we talked for 2.5 hours and I recorded it. And he finally was like, wow, I didn't realize you were only 25. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I was 25. He's like, so you were learning from us. I was like, pretty much. And I never heard him say, he's like, man, you're a brilliant cat, man. And I was like, if nothing else happens between me and him, that was enough.
Yeah.
That was enough, you know, because they don't give you, they just publicly, privately, they just don't tell anybody what I had to do with it. You know, people think it was Spike Lee and the Four Kings. And I'm like, okay, look at the credits and then look at the royalty
production
checks.
Production behind it, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So
without a team, they can't make it.
Exactly. No I in team. Bernie was different. And I got to be honest, not because he passed away, but even in his book that he wrote, he gave me like a whole 2 pages. And he just told the story. He wasn't trying to like flatter me or anything. He's like, hey, this is what happened. I got a call my manager, call Walter Beck. This is what we did. Done. Like it was no fluff. He wasn't trying to like just blow smoke. He just told the truth. Them guys have written between them probably 10 to 12 books. And I'm only in one book. So
really? Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy. Wow. I would love to one day like sit down with all of them and be like what happened? Mm-hmm. Like all of these years we let go by. Like what really happened? We did something magical. Definitely. And now we don't all talk. That's crazy. I don't get it.
That's historical.
So, it is. You know, so.
It really is. Especially for our culture. I mean.
Exactly.
And that's why it's so important because it's part of our story. And I was looking at a special on those guys and your name didn't come up. I mean, I was very upset.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I was looking at something on Showtime or something like that, you know, and they were talking about these guys and they were part of the show. And I noticed how they didn't use verbatim, the kings of comedy, just kings, or something to that effect, you know,
right.
Throw it away from kings, the kings of comedy, the original. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got really pissed off about that, just to let you know that I saw it, I caught it, and, you know, I just wish I was in a position at that time to call it out, but I'm calling it out now that that's a distorted history, you know what I mean? So, you know, we all know, you know, I mean, what the importance of Latin entertainment was and the kings of comedy, the queens of comedy. But that's another segue. Right. What is the difference of having a group of kings and a group of queens?
Oh, wow. Yes.
I needed Xanax after that one.
Yeah, I wanted to lighten it up. Sure. Yeah, I want to throw you a little bit there.
Man, I'll tell you a story. We can move on.
Yeah.
So kings and queens together, we sold out the Georgia Dome. It was like 70,000 people, something like that. Crazy. Mm-hmm. And Cedric, they all came out during soundcheck. But when Cedric came out during soundcheck and looked at this, the amount of seats, he was like, I want a raise. And I'm like, that's what? Like him. First, I thought it was he's being funny. But come to find out, he had a meeting with all the kings and all the queens. And said, we should ask for more money because this place is sold out. First of all, if the place hadn't sold out and there's only 50% of the people there, I still would have had to pay you, even though I was losing money. So now that I made money, or I seem to be making money, you want more than your contract said. The contract says X, I'm going to pay you X. Right. But guess what I did? I talked to my partner. He said, Walter, you're going to make a ton of money tonight. Just give them the money. And I gave him the money.
Right.
I just moved on with my life. Right. Bernie said he was crazy. Some more said that's more money I ever made in my life. I'm not walking away from that. Nobody agreed with him and nobody was on his side. But business wise, I just had to make a decision. And if I had to do it over, I probably would have. Just like you said, it's so much money. Like we're haggling over this little bit of money. Take the money.
Right. Right, right.
Let me take mine. You take yours, and I'm guaranteeing you, mine is way, way more than yours. But I just think it was so disrespectful to bring the other comedians in. Now, if it was just me and him, or me and him and his manager, that's one thing. But to try to recruit them to support his case, right, I just thought it was terrible. But that gives you an idea of what life is like with kings and queens. I bought Rolexes for the kings during their tour. Not the tour they did together, but the tour they did alone. I bought them four of them Rolexes. Then when the queens were in New York, I had them go to the Louis Vuitton store, and I gave the Louis Vuitton store my credit card. It was like, you know, they're coming in, they whatever they want, just charge it to the. She got mad. She got her luggage, and then she got mad and tried to get everybody. Well, why would he just buy us luggage and he bought them Rolexes? Wow. I was like, okay.
You just can't do right. Yeah, you have to send them to Tiffany's.
Enough. Right. I guess I should have, but my point is, I was selling, you know, anywhere from 18,000 to 40,000 tickets per city with the Kings. Right. I was only seating 2,500 people with y'all. It wasn't even in the budget to buy luggage. Right. I just did that trying to be, you know, nice. But bottom line, that's kind of the stories that make you understand. Mm-hmm. You know, what it's like, you know, being with them. So.
Wow. That supports it. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
A lot of personalities.
Okay.
Okay.
Hard to please everybody, right?
You can't please everybody, so don't try.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I want to move on to what are some of the things you're actively pursuing now? You know, what's out there in the future that you are actively working on, that you already got in a can, and things of that nature?
Well, we're actually, like I told you, we just finalized the deal with CBS and Viacom. So we're going to produce, hopefully, if knock on wood, things go right, a 6-part series, reality series, in search of the next king and queen of comedy.
Oh, nice.
So, I've been wanting to do that for a long time. So the right people came along. Like I said, as far as, you know, being patient and waiting for things to line up. So that's in the can. We did something, you probably remember this, Comedy After Dark. We did it, shot it in Miami.
Yeah.
Well, Paramount, again, they just picked that up to add to their catalog. So that was a really big win for us.
Excellent.
You know, to, because we own all of our content. So anytime we have, you know, opportunities to get it distributed, this it's all profit because, you know,
that
we own
great.
It.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah.
Was so, that yeah, something that was a struggle at the beginning to own your content?
It was necessary. Oh, this is the thing. This is funny you say that. They MTV would only put up half the money for the movie.
Right. Oh, okay.
So I had to come up with the rest.
Right.
And because I had to come up with the rest, which I did, it put me in the position of ownership. So instead of just being a producer for hire and they hired me to do the job, I actually put the money up. And because I put the money up, I got 50% of the profits forever. And they just renewed that actually through 2030. So they're still, you know, they're going to distribute Kings all the way through 2030.
Incredible.
Wow. So anything that they get paid, let's say they get $1 million and it runs on Showtime, you'll get $500,000.
That's right.
Right. Exactly. After everybody's
like,
paid.
Like Disney, every time right. That's right.
Oh my God. I got so many. Yes. I got thoughts about that. But yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
Awesome.
Okay. Now, I understand that you are also a philanthropist through mm-hmm. the Walter Latham Foundation. Mm-hmm. And one of your charities is the Urban Outlaw Scholarship Fund.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
The Scholarship Fund, we've given money to high school seniors in North Carolina mm-hmm. probably for the last decade, maybe. So basically, in my grandfather's honor, my grandfather had like probably a sixth grade education. But I learned more from him probably than I learned from a lot of people, you know, even with his limited, you know, dialect, yeah. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you know, how granddaddy talk, you know, but
yeah,
I got it out of it. So
that's amazing.
I don't.
What an honor.
Yeah. I don't know. I get real choked up about it. Yeah. But granddad, he just pointed me in directions at the time I didn't know where I was being pointed in. And then so when I look back at how he kind of push me this way or push me that way, you know, I had to kind of honor him in some way. So through my foundation, we started this scholarship fund. A few of the kids are doctors now. They're lawyers. They're like, everybody we gave money to is like super successful. So yeah, man. So that's it. You know, the granddad was like, you got to leave something behind. He told me a story. He was driving down a back road and on the left, it was just a bunch of farmland and timber and all that, and to the right it was nothing. And he's like, see, this is what we'll do what's on the right. We'll inherit land, we'll sell the land, and then look up, and we don't have no money, no land, no nothing. But he said what everybody else does, for lack of a better word, I think, you know, they keep their land, like these people on the left,
right?
And they farm their land and they grow timber and they keep it in the family and they have something. But generation after generation. And when I was young, I didn't understand what he was talking about. Like but as I got older, I realized, wow, you have to leave a legacy behind. You have to leave a legacy behind. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's not an option.
Right.
So, you know, my kids are a legacy. The scholarship, obviously, is a legacy, remembering my granddad and all that he did, played in my life. But yeah, that's a real tough one. Yeah, because I think about him every time you mention it, and I miss him a lot. So, you know, but I'm hoping. Like, one of the things when I got pretty successful, I was like, man, dang, I wanted him to see it so bad. Like, I wanted him to see me. I'm praying that he does, because, yeah.
Well, yeah, he does. He does. He's up there. I'm
beautiful
sure.
thing to honor him.
I'm
like
sure.
That.
And it's great. You know, what you're doing and done is great. You know, he couldn't ask for more than that. He wouldn't even ask for more than that.
He wouldn't.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. All right. So,
amazing.
I'm going to turn our attention rather to, you know, the racial atmosphere in this country now. I mean, how has that impacted you emotionally, or how are you? You know, you see life and the realities of how people can see things so differently. Yeah, what do you think of the racial atmosphere in the country, the way things can, where people can see two different things, two different realities? How has that impacted you?
What?
The racial atmosphere in this country.
The racial atmosphere?
The division.
Mm-hmm. That's a hard question.
Yeah.
I think it affects me as a man, as a black man. just to kind of see things you can't believe you're seeing and things that are taking place you can't believe that are taking place. Right. They haven't affected necessarily my business. I actually think it actually helped African Americans in the entertainment business because it's such an awareness now of, you know, the African American talent that Hollywood is like, man, we need to listen. We're like other people are trying to listen. So they've stepped up. Regina King is doing great things. And
yes,
I mean, it's just, I can keep going, but I think a lot of that success now, our opportunities now came from us being shunned. You know, right. We barely won Academy Awards. We were barely even nominated for any. They were, you know, only a handful of black movies a year. Then you got black producers, but you know, they're doing everything. And then you have right. all these streaming services who need content. Regular movie studios need content, and they're buying a lot of content from people of color. So that's great. You know, when we pitched this idea that I was telling you about to CBS, right. I was like, CBS is so white. Like, I right. just can't see it. But they see it. They understand that there's a value in our, you know, in our audience.
Culture.
Mm-hmm. In our culture, exactly. So, yeah, man. Yeah.
You're jumping on that train, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, train was late coming, but at least I can get on it. So,
right.
You know, that's all we can ask, you know, for okay. our chance. I don't want anything given to me. No, I just want an opportunity that I worked for. That's all I want.
You know, yeah, level playing field. That's what
level playing exactly. Level
exactly. Playing. And it's just not in Hollywood, you know, it's just black entrepreneurs as well, you know,
yeah.
with all of this, especially for COVID 2020, a lot of black businesses opened up during 2020. We just took that opportunity. I know I was one of them.
Yep.
That's yeah, right. Cash flow. You had the cash flow, right. so that afforded you the opportunity.
You see that's right. When you see the right. opportunity, don't let it pass by. Right. As we discussed earlier, yeah.
All right. On a lighter note, and I did want to get to this. I understand that you want to raise horses. Oh. Did you start doing that? And what are your plans? Are you going to have one in the Kentucky Derby? Goal, or you just want to just ride? Like
I'm going to have a Kentucky. John Wayne. I'm going to have a Kentucky Derby horse. That's what I'm having.
Awesome.
Thoroughbred. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Real deal. Yeah. I've been wanting to get into that business for a long time. I had the pleasure of sitting next to Bob Baffert on a flight from Los Angeles to Cincinnati, I think it was. And Bob Baffert,
heard that name.
He's the winningest horse trainer in history.
Wow.
He had two Triple Crown winners in the last 6 years.
Awesome. So, that's amazing.
Yeah, and he taught me, yeah. you know, he gave me some lessons. I wish I could have recorded it back then, but yeah, I mean, I was sold before he said it, and I'm definitely sold now. I love horses. You know that, but I love horses and I love the South. You know,
right.
There's certain things that really do it for me. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to getting into some horse training and hopefully have that's a derby derby winner run there.
All right. I'm looking
we'll
forward
be at
to that,
that one. Definitely.
That. I want to just that's ride a, like the Duke.
Make sure you invite us.
I just want to ride like the Duke.
I've never told anyone this but Yolanda, so it's an exclusive.
Exclusive, yes. We are honored for that one.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, we are. We are. You go beyond words over here. I get choked up a little bit. Right. But what words of wisdom would you give to the younger generation now that hope to become entrepreneurs, even though you know we've touched upon it throughout the whole show, but mm-hmm. in closing, what would you tell them?
Never let anybody steal your dream.
Mm.
That's what comes to me immediately. Your dream, and I'm not saying someone just took it out of your pocket. I'm thinking your dream deferred. I have this thing: a dream deferred is a dream denied. And a lot of people make excuses. Well, I can't be successful in this because I'm not in Hollywood. I can't do this because I'm not in New York. And my father, I'm like, dude, I'm running a multi-million-dollar company out of a house most of the time.
Right.
In Greensboro. Like, people don't even know where that is. Like, so that, to me, your circumstances should not affect your pursuit of the dream that you're trying to, you know, it should not. Well, you know, we brought in projects and mom worked three jobs. Okay. What does that got to do with you pursuing your dream? You should be more inclined, considering where your background is, that you want to do better. You know, so I would just say pursue your dream and don't let anybody or anything interfere with it. I think you'll be quite happy at the end of the day that you followed your dream and you didn't let it get sidetracked, you know, by someone else.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very
much. That's amazing.
You have any questions for Walter and Michelle?
I do, but I don't know if it'll be inappropriate for production because I've been trying to get on movie sets because I'm a hairstylist. I work with New York Fashion Week. I do music videos, stuff like that. Everything is connections. So I know a lot of people want people in the union. And when I apply for the union, they're like, oh, you have to have production work. How do I get production work if I can't get in a union? You know, do you have any advice for people that are trying to get in the industry and that part of it? That's kind of like back office behind the scenes.
I would just say, you know, get in. You know, everybody got to get in somewhere. Mm-hmm, you know, my son is my son. But if he came on my production, I would probably make him a PA.
Right.
And that's running errands. And you know what that is.
Yeah, production.
Yes.
You
know,
because
production assistants.
You know, exactly. Well, because you're Michael Latham don't mean you get a pass.
Right.
So I would just say, you know, don't take anything as a, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just I would say get in and then make your mark. Don't, you know, so a lot of people are like, well, if I don't get in as this, then I'm not going to. Well, you don't really want to do it then. Because I'm telling you, get in. Just get in.
Just get in the door. I mean, I've done free stuff. I did my first music videos was with Nile Rodgers.
Oh, wow.
And I was bringing him food. I was ironing his shirt. I was doing hair. But he's looking at me like, who's going to feed me? So I'm like, don't worry. I got you. You know?
Right.
So that led me to two more videos with him. So, yeah, you're right. Like, I will, you know, guide you to the restroom.
So good. And it's the little things. When I look back at my career real quick, I'll tell you one of the reasons Chris Tucker said he wanted to do his tours because I had put so much effort into everything from catering to, you know, making sure his room was nice and comfortable to make sure people weren't backstage. You do whatever, you know, whatever it takes. And because of that effort, you know, I didn't ask for an award, but because of the effort I made, he said, hey, let's do this bigger thing together. I don't know if it's because I paid attention to all those details. I would like to think they had something to do with it.
Of course they did, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so.
They remember your work ethics.
Exactly. They remember your work ethic. And that's when you're out there grinding with them where nobody's really making a whole lot of money, but you put forth effort. Like you are making the money and you believe the money is coming. So you've got to work. When you're on set, when you are actually on set, you have to know in your head, this is just a stepping stone to where I'm trying to really go.
Right.
And I'm okay with that. A lot of kids don't want to take the step. They want to just boom, just be in it.
Yeah. And I didn't mind. I was like, I'm next to Nile Rodgers. What do you want to eat? You want something to drink? Like I was just excited to be in that environment and I knew it was going to take me and I did it for free. I did all of the videos for free. And then my fifth one, I actually got paid.
That's what it takes.
Yeah.
That's what it takes.
Okay. All right. We're pushing
up
against
the
clock.
Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Mm-hmm. I wish you the best with that too.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'll be looking for my ticket to the Kentucky Derby though.
Yes, please.
Oh yeah. I'm definitely going to be down there. Wheel me in. Wheel me in. Wheel me in.
All right.
All right.
Awesome.
But
thank you so much.
I would like to thank you, Walter Latham Jr., for joining the Walt Weekly, for being on the Walt Weekly podcast. And our 101st episode, I have Walter Latham Jr., CEO of Latham Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't get any better than that. You know, father, and I got me interviewing my son, believe it or not.
Yes.
And I'm in retirement, you know. So when he said earlier, oh, man, I hit 50. How do you think I felt?
Right.
I
know. I know what it's like.
Yeah. So, you're 50. So, I'm older than that. So,
there you go.
But, I just want to.
Still going you strong, though.
Great sense. But, hey, we'll talk soon.
Take care. Stay blessed.
All right. Love you too. All right. Bye-bye.